reel-to-reel recorder.
This is File 86. This is Jane McMillan. I am interviewing Peter Oliver on many things: building inspector, first selectman, his house at 31 Millerton Road, some good stories about whatever he feels like it. Today is November 21st, 2014, and we'll start with the family information.
My family information.
Your family information. What, sir, is your name?
My name is Peter MacGregor Oliver.
And how do you spell the Kemble?
K-E-M-B-L-E.
And is with the McGregor, is it an M-C or an M-A-C?
M-A-C, capital G.
Yep. And your birthday?
6-3-46.
Birthplace?
Plainfield, New Jersey.
Your parents' names?
Wadsworth Terry Oliver and Catherine Brown Oliver.
And do you have siblings?
I have one sister, Catherine Terry Oliver.
And is the Catherine spelled with a K?
K, K and an A. K-A-T-H-A-R-I-N-E.
Your educational background?
My educational background is the public school system of Plainfield, New Jersey, Hubbard School, up to the third grade, and then Stark School in Glenbrook, Connecticut, which is a little village in Stamford. And then I went to the King School, which is now a huge conglomerate school called the King Lohaywood Thomas School, where three separate private schools have all merged. And from there I went to Trinity Pauling. And from Trinity Pauling I went into the United States Marine Corps.
Wonderful.
Which was the school of practical reality.
And, yes.
And then from the Marine Corps, I went to Boston University, and then the University of Denver, and now I'm just a student of the world.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
I'm going to ask you about your grandfather, Leslie Allen Oliver.
Yes.
He was in Sharon.
Yes, he bought a house in 1911, I believe. I may be off by a year, but and he was an architect. He was with the firm of Ford, Butler, and Oliver, which had a practice on Madison Avenue in New York City, and he moved out to... do you mind if I get my phone? I'm sorry.
We were talking about your
Leslie
friend,
Allen Oliver.
Leslie Allen Oliver, and he was an architect. And what firm did he work for?
Ford, Butler, and Oliver. He was the principal, and did a lot of work with libraries and public buildings. But he had his home, his second home, in Sharon, Connecticut, on Old Sharon Road number 3, in a house that was, he always called it the Winthrop House, and I don't know if that's, my father always called it the Winthrop House. I'm not sure what the antecedent is there. My father and his elder sister and brother started living there in 1912. My uncle was born in 1908, and my aunt was born in 1909. My father was born in 1911, or 12. It's always been a dispute. I think he tried to be older than he wanted to be. And they were very happy to be in Sharon.
Now, your grandfather... Mm-hmm. Worked on the Admiral Hart property.
Oh, yes. He was... It's interesting. I think that if someone were to contact Mr. Prindle, in Sharon, he probably knows as much as anything, because the house that he was living in, I know, was redesigned by my grandfather back in the 20s. Prior to the Depression, he was a very busy man, helping people to modify their homes. Unfortunately, his book of renderings, which I always prided and loved to refer to, I had taken to show to someone, actually Reed Gillette from Sharon, and it was sitting in the town hall the day the town hall burned down.
And that segues right into, please tell me something about the town hall fire. From your perspective, your office.
Well, I think that that for those who never knew the old town hall, it was a great old building that had been redesigned from its colonial antecedents into something vaguely Victorian and then back again. And the town hall worked. There was a large meeting hall on the second floor that had a lovely painting that was the backdrop for the screen that crossed the stage. And there were dozens and dozens of wooden benches with fabulous iron cast sides that folded so that they could be put off to the side. And it was a place where more angry words and positive thoughts were expressed on an absolutely regular basis whenever we had a town hall meeting.
Now, that mural, wasn't that of Twin Lakes?
It was. It was of Twin Lakes, but it was huge.
I remember
it. You know, 15 feet tall and probably 24 feet wide. And on the back of the stage, there was a very large square Steinway piano. And I always remember the piano because the building official who trained me was Francis Henry Sand Rossier, and his granddaughter was taking piano lessons, and he would bring her down from her home to the town hall and then take her to Salisbury Central. And it was a very odd day when Jennifer didn't get up on that stage and play the piano. And it was just a wonderful thing to have happen to. But it that building was my home. I mean, I spent so much time in it. It was inconvenient, non-code complying as far as as far as access. The tax collector was on the second floor, her office being right next to mine.
Who was tax collector at the time?
That was Denise Rice. And but it was non-compliant because, in fact, if someone was disabled, they couldn't get up to see her. So we installed a doorbell that if someone wanted the tax collector to come down, they would press the button and down Denise would go to take care of the needs of the citizen. Then back in those days, Joe Pinkham was the sanitarian. Janet Moss was the bookkeeper, and Doretta Belter was the selectman's secretary, and that made up the congregation of people who lived on the second floor.
These were all on the second floor?
All on the second floor.
Who was on the first floor?
Well, let's see. We had Lila Nash.
And she was town clerk?
She was town clerk. Her assistant was Pat Gomez. The assessor was William H. Silta. And then you had Charlotte Reed's office, which was the first selectman's office. And that was it. Because the rest of the first floor was meeting area.
Yeah.
And it was a lovely building. Post and beam, built with hammer trusses. It was built in the 1700s. And it was just a marvelous bit of the home of a town.
Now, we were speaking earlier about the fire.
I forgot the basement.
All right. Basement? Sorry?
Basement, yes. We had in the basement was the judge of probate.
Right. And that was Dick Fitzgerald?
Oh, no. It was long before Dick. And I'm showing my age because I can't remember who it was at the moment. It'll come to me.
Oh, good.
I'll wake up screaming in the middle of the night.
Okay. I that happens more than once.
Yeah.
You were mentioning earlier about the damage that was done.
Yes.
Irreparable damage that was done. Would you speak a little bit about that? I know a lot of things were saved, but...
A lot of things were saved and a lot of things were destroyed. The fire actually started in Bill Silt's office, which had an open door to the first selectman's office. And there were vast indications of an accelerant being put on the floor after the fire. But, accelerants were obvious once the fire had been put out, but they had been in Bill Silt's office, and it had burned directly from Bill Silt's office into Charlotte's office. Charlotte's office was just cremated. And it being post and beam, and there not being...
It was balloon construction?
Oh, no, it was post and beam. But that just meant that there were cavities in the walls that were large enough and acted like chimneys, so that the fire burned up in the walls across into Denise Rice's office. And from Denise Rice's office to the north was the meeting room, and it swept through the meeting room with, you know, wood that had been dry for...
Years?
You know, hundreds of years. From Denise's office, it also spread into the building inspector's office, which was my office. And unfortunately, we had non-fire retardant drapes and things over the windows, and it literally swept all the way around in a U shape and destroyed all of the blueprints that were on file, all of the permits were in file cabinets. Unfortunately, the file cabinets were open.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a devastation there, and then into the selectman secretary's office and across into Janet Moss's office. And the town hall, the heart of the town, was truly damaged that night, because we lost so many things, including paintings. There was one of the Fox in the Season paintings.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
That was
there were four of those
that went
there.
Up, and then there were paintings in the town clerk's office that also were destroyed. Tragic.
That was 1985, August of 85. And the vault wasn't damaged as far as the records in there, or were they smoke and water damaged?
It's interesting. If you look at the new town hall, you have to remember that the new town hall is about 20 feet longer going towards the... what used to be, I guess, J Stack, or whatever
it
is
okay.
now. And,
it used to be Shadroy's.
The access to the vault was actually down a step.
Right.
And as a result, when they were, you know, when they drained the water tank up on the top of the hill. They literally flooded the vault. So the majority of the damage to the materials that were in the vault was water damage.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a company that was retained to take all of the records and to dry them and to treat them appropriately so that they could be saved. But we went from being able to peruse the original records to... only being able to peruse photocopies that had been made afterwards in order to prevent that from ever happening again. It was...
Very, very tragic. Very tragic.
It really was.
Yeah.
My office, when I worked for Bill Silt in the assessor's office, and I could turn around and I would see the gravestone marker of Deacon Nathaniel Buell.
Mm-hmm.
which is still there, but of course the building, because its functions have been moved down a bit, it's now something that you would look at outside of the back of the building. There are no direct offices there because of our grand staircase.
Right. Okay. When did you start in training with Mr. Silta?
In November of 1979, I had moved from Fairfield County to Lakeville to get back together again with my childhood sweetheart. And it was neutral area for us. Neither one of us was being dragged apart by friends who thought they knew better than we did. And I looked in the newspaper to see if I could bring my vast experience in corporate America to Lakeville and Salisbury, only to find that there were no jobs.
Not in your area.
Yeah, so I started going on interviews. I'd interview for anything, even if the job really wasn't something that was seriously mine. And I was offered the job as the assistant to Bill Silta, who was the assessor, conservation commission administrator, planning and zoning enforcement officer. I think that was it for Bill's functions, and as the assessor, of course. But and the job also was to be the assistant to Henry Rossier, who was the building inspector, and they took two totally disparate functions and made one job out of it. And I started working for the town for the munificent fund of $12,000 a year, which at the time...
That was still good money.
Well, it wasn't...
Compared to a school teacher?
Oh, no, actually, David Beresdorfer and I used to have the conversation, because we're friends, and we were making within $500 of each other. So
yeah, but you're both men.
I had never noticed that.
Women's scale wasn't necessarily the same rate as men.
Aren't you glad that times have improved?
Too bad I retired 24 years ago.
Anyway, so I started working with Bill Silta. He had me handwrite, it was the last handwritten grand list in 1979.
Oh, that must have been fun.
It would have been fun. It would have been better if, in fact, I hadn't, by state decree, been forced to fill in a form which was predicated on computer ideas, not anything else. I'm sorry.
All right. Now, you were telling me about handwriting the grand list that was set up for computers rather than...
Right. Well, the grand lists that were intended for to be written by hand, they would have the lot size, the number of buildings, accessory structures, etc. And they were just written out in columns. Mm-hmm. And in the new one, there was a space that was about 3/4 inch by perhaps the same, into which you had to write the computer code and then write in the numbers that were reflected by the assessments. It was
mouse print.
It was a laborious task, and when all was said and done, it was a good way of learning about the town.
Yes, it would be. It would be, because you'd have to write everybody's name.
Everybody's name. I had to write everybody's name and their address, and so it. At that point, I was also working for Henry Rossier, going out and doing inspections. So it all was a very well thought out educational plan to teach someone A, what the values were, and then B, you know, where they were. So it was.
It was on the job training.
Absolutely,
absolutely.
And there's nothing better than on the job training from people who
know what they're doing.
Who know what they're doing. Exactly.
Oh, absolutely.
Henry Rossier having been an engineer who had worked with Bosch and Lohm at one point, had numerous patents in his own name. Mm-hmm. A brilliant man, although slightly curmudgeonous. he was a tremendous teacher, and I'd always wished he had a little more of a sense of humor. But
how can one get through life if you don't have a sense of humor? I really don't know.
I've often wondered why anyone would hide behind the door when they were passing out senses of humor.
I know, but that's the way it is. When did you actually become building inspector?
In 1985.
And you were building inspector for how long?
Actually, not all that long. It was, I was in the office for about 13 years, so that would mean that I was actually the building inspector only for 7 or 8.
And you trained?
I trained the current building inspector, Mike Fitting.
Mike Fitting. Okay.
Mike had been working with the fire marshal's office as an assistant fire marshal, and he was a contractor, and he really wanted to get out of contracting, and he asked if, in fact, he could become an assistant building inspector, and I said that it would be a good idea. However, there wasn't a whole lot in the budget to support his position, so I started to relinquish portions of my paycheck so that he could get the training and he could make a living and be able to do the job and to really learn the job.
That was very gracious of you. Yes, it was.
Well, my situation in life is not as if I had to depend upon the salary that I was being paid to be the building inspector and the associated jobs, I couldn't have taken the job, nor could anyone who, in fact, had any sense of pride. But my situation was such that
I was able to help someone else.
I was able to do this, and it was fine. Mike has a great sense of humor when you can get at it.
Oh yes.
And I was very pleased that he was able to take over. I resigned from the office of the building official in 1993 after I had been told to perform some anatomically impossible things by the then first selectman Bud Trotta. If I ever saw eye to eye with him, it was only because he was standing on the third step.
Ah. You started the fitness center back in 1990.
Right. My wife, Sally, love of my life, had Lou Gehrig's disease that was diagnosed in 1985. And she was bedridden the last 2.5 years of her life, but she died in 1990, and I recognized at the time that I would most likely either end up being a drunk or a suicide if I didn't stay extremely busy. So I started the fitness center as a way of...
It was very perceptive of you.
Well,
it was.
I have two daughters, and I recognized that I had to stick around to try and do what I could do
for them.
As a parent for them, mm-hmm. and my mm-hmm. thought was that it would also be very nice to watch people getting stronger and better physically, having had the enormity of watching my wife melt.
Yeah.
And so I started that, and Zenas Block once came to me and he said, he was a member of the fitness center, he said, what kind of a study did you do in order to determine that this business would be a success? And I said, well, Zenas, it was as simple as looking around and finding out there wasn't a fitness center here and maybe we could use one.
Market research. Yeah. Where did your first fitness center was located?
Yeah, it was located at 346 Main Street, which was... the back two rooms and spaces at what is now the Boathouse restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Which used to be the First National.
Yes. And
Okay.
I started there, and after 3 years, when I had my blowout with Buddy Trotta, and I tendered my resignation, I then bought the old Kufel and Esser factory building from Frederick Lubischer, mm-hmm. and moved the fitness center in there.
And you were there for
10 years? 14 years.
14 years?
Yeah. Government always scares me. I mean, even though I've been an integral part of the mm-hmm. government in this town at various points for the last 30 years, it scares me because there always seems to be a tremendous lack of logic when large decisions are being made. The town was offered the K&E building for $100,000, which was about $300,000 less than the asking price, by Mr. Lubischer. It was going to be a potential site for the nurses and the daycare mm-hmm. and any other function that would seem to be positive. And an architect was hired. This is also indicative of my love of architects, who walked through the building and said, "Oh no, this building couldn't be used for anything for less than $500,000." Because the way it was laid out.
Configured. Mm-hmm.
And
he didn't have much imagination, did he?
No, I don't know who it was. If I did know, I've put it out of my head so as to protect the guilty.
Sensible.
Yeah.
Sensible.
So I ended up buying the building for $240,000 after Fred had had... There'd been a broken pipe on the fire, mm-hmm. on the fire system, and Fred had hired Parodis to come in and to repair the pipe. And the first door from Holly Street was where this break had taken place, and they'd had to dig up the floor. And Fred, towards the evening, when everybody had left, decided he'd go and take a look at it. He opened the door, took a step inside, fell down into an 8-foot trench, and... At this time, we had been negotiating for the price of the building, and we could not reach an accommodation. And he was stuck there for 14 hours. That afternoon, he called me and he said, "Peter, about the building." And if you knew Fred, that literally is Fred's voice.
Oh, yes.
And so we reached an accommodation, and I bought the building, and...
He was extremely kind to me.
I liked Fred very much.
He owned the former Salisbury Bank and Trust building.
Sure.
And I was teaching sixth grade, and my children had written a bank robbery story, and he loaned us
the use of the building
so we could film our story.
Yeah. Fred and his wife, George, were just a wonderful couple. And the one thing I learned, though, and I learned it very quickly, was if you were dealing with trying to track down the land records, if you came across the name Lubischer, you knew you were screwed. Because he owned so much,
yeah.
And he would trade, and he would do all sorts of things.
He was a wheeler dealer.
He really was. I enjoyed Fred. I was sorry that he had to fall into a pit and motivated to sell the property. It worked. He was one of the real characters in this town.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And this town has had its fair share of good old-fashioned New York characters, New England characters.
Yes.
People who were just...
unique.
Absolutely, entirely. Lila Nash being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Now, you had a Nancy Bushnell story in relation to the fitness center that you told me.
No, not Nancy Bushnell. Nancy Belcher.
Nancy Belcher, oh, okay.
Yeah, Nancy Belcher... was absolutely one of the most uniquely wonderful people she'd ever had a chance to meet. I don't think sugar would have melted in her mouth. She was just someone who was very much a grandmotherly type of a person. And while one of the most wonderful moments for me was that she would come walking in with taking little tiny steps when she came into the fitness center, and then she would meet up with whoever was on the desk at the time, and she'd go around and she'd start to exercise. And she'd end up her exercise program by walking on a treadmill. And after she had done her workout, which was at least four times a week, mm-hmm. and she was in her late 80s at that point, she would stride out of the fitness center as though she had been reborn.
Wonderful.
And Dick Tabor could probably tell you the story better, but he had been to the hospital to see her the night before she passed away. And Nancy said to Dick, and mind you, this is related in the memorial service afterwards, she said, well, you know, I've got to get out of here because I have to get back to my young friends at the Lakeville Fitness Center. It was the only time I'd ever been at a memorial or funeral service where someone was gratuitously just granting me an endorsement.
That's wonderful.
It was fun.
I hope you take it. You also told me a little bit about John Harney being in the Marines and his connection with Anita Kuhn.
Well, you know, as a former Marine myself, I have been very pleased to have participated in what we call the birthday, which is November the 10th, usually one day before Veterans Day or Armistice Day. And John was always very much a proud member of the United States Marine Corps. Wherever he went, he was always wearing at least a necktie or a rosette as a reminder of his participation. I got to know John very well, and of course Anita Kuhn as well, because she was one of the lady Marines, women Marines, back in the Big War.
Yeah, it was.
And John was just always ever so embracing of anybody who'd been in the Marine Corps. And I know that because I was in it, but I also have observed he was totally embracing just about anybody else
on
the face of the planet.
Yeah.
Because it's just his nature. I mean, John and Elise have been, you know, very much a part of this this community, dating back to their running the White Hart and long before Harney T became a worldwide reality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
John was very proud of his service.
That's something to be proud of, to serve your country.
Well, he always earned my respect.
When did you become a selectman?
I ran for the office of first selectman in 1999 at the request of the Republican Town Committee, which was interesting considering that I was an unaffiliated voter mm-hmm. who had resigned from the Democratic Party when Bud Trotta was the first selectman and he was being the combination king and pontiff. But Bob Longley asked me if, in fact, I would be interested in running for the office, and I said, well, who would I be running with? And he said, we really don't care as long as that person's a Republican. So I actually, I was running against Val Bernardoni, who I consider him to be one of my closest allies in life. He, brilliant man,
oh,
best
yes.
Best first selectman that this town has
ever had.
Got more out of people by simply asking them if they would be willing to participate. He would ask someone if they'd be willing to participate in a study, and once the study was completed, he would take their advice.
Yes! That was unusual, wasn't it?
Even to this day, it's impossible. But he was a wonderful man. The person I ran with for an even better Salisbury, was Sandra Gomez, whom I had known as a neighbor, wasn't particularly, you know, close. Mm-hmm. I knew her mother, Pat Gomez, much better than
sure.
I knew Sandy. We ran for office. in those days, if you ran for first selectman and if you were the third greatest vote getter, you would become a member of the Board of Selectmen. Mm-hmm. That has recently been changed, and I don't have much comment about that. But I became a selectman by a margin of 4 votes.
Oh my!
Over Sandy. But it's a good thing that we weren't both elected because we got married about a year later.
That might have been a little ticklish. Yeah. Were there any special projects during the administration that you were involved in that you remember?
Absolutely. Val and I got together and spent a great deal of time. Bless you.
Thank you.
Spent a great deal of time trying to figure out what was going to be happening with municipal solid waste. And there was a program that was just starting around the state called Pay As You Throw.
Oh, yes.
Val and I probably spent 7 months going around to other transfer stations, talking with selectmen and managers and mayors and others and citizens to try and find out about this new system, this new totally equitable system, mm-hmm. in the determination of what it would cost to dispose of the municipal solid waste. And we never got to a point of making a decision because Peggy Botke, who was running a little restaurant called Auntie M's down in Lakeville.
What was her last name?
Botke. I don't know how to spell it. She lives in Lime Rock on Route 112. She came up with the most brilliant anti-ad campaign slogan that I've ever heard in my life. She called Pay As You Throw a bag tax. And with the creation of that phrase, bag tax, Val and I looked at each other and tried to figure out who should shoot the gun first at each other because we knew we yep. were defeated. And we then just said, okay, fine. Mm-hmm.
You cut your losses.
The anti-intellectual atmosphere that was prevalent at the time was, we know better, even though, in fact, we know nothing about what it is you're proposing. And we have figured out that this is going to cost us more, and it's going to be an additional charge and an additional tax, therefore. So Val and I did the only thing that we could reasonably do, which was to say, great, what we're going to do is appoint a committee. We need to know where we're going to be moving the transfer station, because when we first came into office, when Val and I first came into office, we were still on the property at Hotchkiss, as we are at the moment. Mm-hmm. But we had been without a lease for 10 years, and mm-hmm. We went back through the process of creating a new lease and creating a date by which we would be out. And thus began the never-ending
circle of where are we going to do the transfer
station. Where are we going to put the transfer station? And that, of course, was determined by Curtis Rand as to where it was going to be, and monies were expended from the town treasury in contrast and in conflict with the statutes of the state of Connecticut, but I'm not going to go any further in that.
Who was the third person, you and Val and Curtis? Okay. Before we get to the conservation committee, tell me about when did 31 Millerton Road come into your life, and give me some background.
I had been living on Wells Hill on Old Asylum Road since I moved to town in 1979. When my wife passed away, when Sally died, I was very aware of the fact that 10 years later, when I got together with Sandy, that it would be unfair to ask her to move into a home that was populated by my family ghosts, that I wanted to be on neutral ground, and thus we started looking around for property. And at the time, a family named Kessler was living at 31 Millerton Road, and we looked at the house and we thought, gee, here's this wonderful house built in 1862 by the then former government, governor of the state of Connecticut, Alexander Hamilton Holly. And that's as much as we knew. I bought the house. I did a two-year renovation on it.
When did you buy it?
End of 2000. And one day I ran into John Krim Rudd, who was one of those sparkling, wonderful characters in the town. And we got to talking about the fact that I just bought the house, and and he started to relate the fact that when his grandfather had built the house, he had built it for his son, and his son went out to California and died. And as a result, when the house had been finished, using virtually the same leftover materials from the creation of Hollywood, which was where the governor was living back in the 1850s and 60s, he gave the house to his daughter Maria, or Mariah, I'm not sure which, when she decided she was going to be married to William B. Rudd. And thus the name of the house really became the Holly Rudd House. In the two-year renovation that I did, I could never open a wall or remove something without finding some endorsement of in charcoal saying something like, ship to A.H. Holly, Lakeville, Connecticut.
Uh-huh.
And so I had the same marble fireplaces, fireplace surrounds that the governor had in his own house down the road. John, being interested and caring, mm-hmm. Sandy and I loved him, invited us to come over to dinner. And as I remember it, we ended up actually bringing the dinner, but he had laid out a bunch of photographic albums that he had from his family going back to the 1860s, and he had culled out three separate picked photographs, and he said, I'd love you to be able to copy these and get, if you can return the originals, which of course we did, mm-hmm. but there's a photograph taken in about 1863 or 1864 that shows William B. Rudd standing on the porch speaking to Miss Coffing, who's on the astride her horse, and there are four or five other people, including Mr. Jones, who is heading into the back house.
Okay. Lovely.
He gave me a photograph of the house that was taken in 1913, mm-hmm. When they had changed the steps on the front of the house, and then another photograph that he had, which showed the Wenonsco house, which was, mm-hmm. or the Gateway house, depending upon where you tune in on the history, which was right next door.
Yeah.
And John filled us in. I'm getting older and I'm forgetting the genealogy, but there was a period of time when, after speaking with John, I could quote his genealogy on the screen.
Oh, yes. Fortunately, he did it on tape before I took over oral history.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Because...
And then I did Louise Hannigan, who's also a Rudd.
Right, yeah.
And we got to laughing because, well, is it with an E or without an E?
Yeah.
You know, and the names were absolutely fabulous, absolutely fabulous.
Yeah.
And now you are no longer living at 31 Millerton Road at this point. You're
at the moment, I'm not. I mean, I own it. What we're doing now is about 7 or 8 years ago, my bride and I realized that having a 7-bedroom house was not necessarily the most economical way of living, and we talked about the possibility of renting the building. we ended up renting the house to Hotchkiss for one of their IT person. Mm-hmm. And they loved it. We loved them. They were great tenants. But they moved out about 3 months ago when he was offered the job of IT at Princeton Day School in Princeton, New Jersey. So they moved out, and we moved in to try and to refurbish because after 7 years of occupancy,
it needs a little wear. It needed
work. So.
Mine was rented for 18 years.
That's a record. I like that. I love 31 Millerton Road. It's a wonderful house, 9-foot ceilings, and all the touches of
elegant
mid Victorian construction. And I would move back there in a shot. It's interesting because although it is in fact mid Victorian, considering that Victoria assumed the stage in I think 1837, the house is post and beam. Unlike the transitional framing that was normally being used in the mid 1860s and early 1860s.
Briefly explain post and beam construction because I'm not.
Oh, I'm sorry. Post and beam is very simple. It's just that it's posts into which are set with mortise and tenon.
Okay.
They're built in what they call bents, which means that you build 4 or 5 or 6 identical units, and then you tilt them up, and you put other beams in, which are going to cross-connect to the next bent.
Okay.
So instead of having individual pieces of wood, like as you have today in what they call stick building, you had larger timbers, which were being held together not by nails, not by screws, but just by mortise and tenon and pins. And it's a great old house, and you know, every time that I get involved in any kind of a construction project involving my wife, I know I'm going to have a lot to do. And
well, that's good. It keeps you out of mischief.
It keeps me out of mischief. Yes.
Tell me about the conservation committee that you're on.
The Conservation Commission was founded by statute in 1972. And it was vested with the responsibilities of overseeing and protecting wetlands and watercourses and ponds and vernal ponds. It's a commission that I have, of all the commissions, committees, groups I've dealt with, it has always been the most practical group of neighbors who get together and who are willing to listen to an applicant to make a presentation. We do not have prohibited areas. What we have are regulated areas. The difference being that if it's prohibited and it says you may not do anything within 100 feet of, that's a prohibition which has to be followed.
Right.
In a regulated sense, if someone says, well, I want to build a gazebo, which is going to have no plumbing, no electrical, no nothing, and it's not going to pose any injurious threat to the wetlands, we will be able to adjudicate that on a logical and rational basis. It's been a great group of people. Doris Walker, Audrey Whitbeck. I'm going back in time now, obviously.
Yeah.
Martha Briscoe. I don't know if you ever knew Martha.
Just the name.
Martha was the world's most pragmatic and marvelous human being. Mm-hmm. This is a story about Curtis Rand. If you watch him in any meeting, he still does it to today. And I just laugh every time he does it because I think of Martha Briscoe. Curtis will say, well, you know, I feel. And I can remember Martha Briscoe slapping a table so hard that it almost came off the ground. And she said, for the love of all that's holy, stop feeling and start thinking. But he still does it. He still says it.
He did not do it last night at the special meeting.
Okay, but
he
does do that.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
It's just, it's one of his, and I know that he thinks the two are interchangeable, and they're not.
What's the term of office, or isn't there a term of office?
Well, there's a term of office which is 4 years, but for the most part, once one goes on...
One stays.
One stays as long as one wants to.
Ah, that's nice.
It's a great group of people, and Curtis was the chairman of it for probably 18 years.
How many members are there now?
There are... 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There are 9 members.
I think I've come to the end of my questions, but is there something that you'd like to add to this before we close?
Just the reminder that those who do not learn the lessons of history are condemned to repeat them. So I think that being able to learn to listen is the greatest gift that these tapes can feed into.
Well, thank you very much for your time and your knowledge and your sense of humor.
Well, thank you.